Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle. And of course, if this is your first time listening or you just recently found us, thank you so much for putting us in your ears. Get in touch with us on social at IT Women's Podcast or email us thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. We love hearing from you. Today, we are talking about narcissistic mothers and the impact they can have on their daughters.
The mother will be extremely critical, condescending, really oppressive, very judgmental. Oh, you're not wearing that, are you? You know, it's the entitlement, the expectation of you should drop everything and go and do their shopping, even if you are about to give a, I don't know, conference for 10,000 people. She is more important than anybody else. And if you ever disagree with that, you're going to get punished.
That was Helen Villers there, and more from her and her co-author later on. First, I just wanted to mention the brilliant primetime documentary about abortion services in Ireland, which has led to accusations that government parties have not done enough to advance abortion services in Ireland since the Eighth Amendment was repealed in 2018. We've talked about this on the podcast before, and the documentary showed the difficulties still faced by women and also highlighted a number of unregulated services which pose as legitimate pregnancy agency services operating in Ireland, one on Parnell Street in Dublin. I really appreciated the response of some politicians, such as Stephen Donnelly, who said he would raise the issue at Cabinet and talk about bringing in new measures to tackle what he described as false services that are tricking women about their abortion rights. And Social Democrats leader Holly Kearns said the programme was difficult to watch. 6 years after the repeal vote, we are still failing women who are being forced to travel to the UK for care. So hopefully that documentary might have an impact and there will be more discussion about removing what Kearns called the patronising and patriarchal mandatory 3-day waiting period, which of course we have also talked about on this podcast. Now, narcissistic personality disorder, or NPD, is a mental health condition in which people have an unreasonably high sense of their own importance. They need and seek too much attention and want people to admire them. People with this disorder may lack the ability to understand or care about the feelings of others. 0.5 to 1.6 of the population have diagnosable NPD. However, lots of cases fly under the radar and someone with the condition is not going to seek a diagnosis. And growing up as the child of a narcissist can be hugely damaging and have lifelong consequences. And my guests today are experts in that, as the authors of a fascinating book called You're Not the Problem, The Impact of Narcissism and Emotional Abuse and How to Heal. Helen Villers is a psychotherapist and couples therapist with a master's in working with children of narcissistic parents. She worked for the NHS for 5 years and now has a busy private practice, as well as working with clients recovering from narcissistic abuse. She also specialises in autism and ADHD. Her co-author, Katie McKenna, is a psychotherapist who specialises in emotional abuse and parentification, something we're going to be talking about a lot today. And she educates adults on how their childhood relationships are impacting their current relationships, helping them to recognize and heal from lifelong impacts of dysfunctional family dynamics through the psychotherapy process. Both women host the successful podcast Insight, where they play agony aunt to listeners, responding to letters, offering insights and healing. So we had a fascinating conversation. We talked about what a narcissist looks like, how their emotional abuse from parent to child has become in some ways socially acceptable. And we look closely, because this is the Women's Podcast after all, about the impact of narcissistic mothers on daughters, which is a subject that doesn't get talked about a lot. Here they are, Helen Villers and Katie McKenna, on narcissism and emotional abuse in families, and most importantly, how to heal from it. So Helen Villers and Katie McKenna, delighted to have you on the podcast to talk about the impact of narcissism and emotional abuse and how to heal, and your book, which is called You're Not the Problem, which is a great title because it shows people that they are not the problem, which is always a good thing. I want to ask you first, Helen and Katie, how did you come together on this to write this book?
Well, we met on social media and then we just hit it off straight away and formed a friendship. Then we made a podcast, and then we were like, we both had wanted to write a book independently of each other, and then it just made so much sense to try and do it together with both of our knowledge and both of our experience. And so that's how it was born. And we just wanted desperately to provide a resource to people, because, you know, not everyone can get into therapy and everything else, and just to have all this information in one place was kind of absolutely a goal for us, wasn't it?
It absolutely was. We were very aligned professionally, yeah, and then we hit it off with a friendship, yeah, as well. It was really cool.
That's an added bonus. So listen, let's start with the basics. What is a narcissist?
A narcissist is somebody who, well, first of all, actually, I might as well talk about that. We all have narcissistic traits, and this is something people get a bit confused about. And the difference is whether or not we're healthy or unhealthy. And with the traits, I mean. And so when we're talking about narcissism, we're talking about NPD type toxic narcissistic traits, which are grandiosity, entitlement, exploitation, motivational empathy, and impaired self-awareness. And the idea being that those five main traits would show up both healthily or unhealthily in a person, but when they're unhealthy, they are really toxic, really damaging to relationships and the people around those people exhibiting the traits.
Okay, so let's go through the characteristics so people can maybe recognize what they are and how they manifest in a person.
Okay, so grandiosity is the, you know, the people that are like, I'm the best at everything. And if you've been to Tenerife, they've been to 11 a reef. They've like, if you've had a sore leg, they've had a leg amputated. You know, it's that kind of the big I am. They'll tell you that they're the best at everything. The way that they do everything is the best way to do everything. And that they are thinking about themselves in that way with absolutely no foundation. So there's a really false sense of superiority, of self-belief in themselves. Katie, do you want to talk about
entitlement? Again, there is healthy entitlement, like, you know, I might be entitled to maternity leave, or, you know, unhealthy entitlement is when I think that I deserve something and it doesn't matter what the cost is to the other person, I want that thing. So I could be a narcissistic person. If we look at it in the parental relationship, and let's use an example of a mother and daughter in this relationship, their mother could feel entitled to their daughter's time, to their daughter's money, to their daughter's clothes, to their grandchildren, to even, let's say, her husband's labor or the daughter's labor. So they feel entitled to absolutely everything. There's nothing it doesn't touch.
And then we come to exploitation, and they sit really closely together with the exploitation and entitlement, because they feel entitled. For example, like if I wanted to go on holiday, but I don't have the money to pay for it, I might exploit a friend of mine to borrow the money to be able to go on the holiday because I feel very entitled, but I'm not going to work and earn for it myself. I'm going to just get my wicked way that way. Do you know what I mean? It's that kind of manipulation of somebody to get a need met. So exploitation and entitlement are very closely aligned, that one feeds the other. They're all feeding grandiosity though, aren't they?
Yeah, that grandiosity that the whole world revolves around me. And then if we move on to motivational empathy, and this can be known as guilt tripping or pulling at heartstrings. So this is where the narcissistic parent would weaponize their child's empathy and guilt against them. So if the parent wants to go shopping, for example, you know, can you take me into town? And it might be asked as a question, whereas because of this entitlement, it's actually a demand. And if the child says no or even hesitates, oh, that's terrible. Well, if it's so important for you to go and meet your friend, then don't worry about little old me, right? And there's the motivational empathy to try and pull at your heartstrings, elicit your guilt, to tell you that you're the problem here. Whereas they're not the problem. What's happening is that their no is being punished. But because it's not done in an overt way, which would be, how dare you say no to me? which is still, you know, eliciting the same feeling, because it's done more hidden. A lot of people aren't aware of what motivational empathy is.
Yeah. And then and then just to add on to what Kate was saying, one of the biggest misconceptions around NPD or narcissism is
that, NPD is, narcissistic personality disorder.
Narcissistic personality. So we're so used to saying it, we just forget that other people. So the biggest, two biggest misconceptions about narcissism is that there's a complete lack of empathy and a complete lack of self-awareness. Mm. And actually trying to understand that there's motivational empathy and impaired self-awareness is really helpful in the healing process, because it's understanding that those times that were nice when they were kind to you was still for their benefit. It wasn't really for your benefit. It was for them to get whatever they wanted, whether it was lack of accountability, etc. So when we're talking then about the impaired self-awareness, we're talking about there's enough knowledge of self to know that the behavior is wrong because they know to hide it. There's enough knowledge to know if I do X and Y, I will get Z. So if I exploit you, I will get that, and then I will feel better about myself. And there's enough knowledge to know that there is a need for dominance and control of others, and an anger when that isn't given. What there is not is the awareness, the self-awareness, to be able to sit and say, why am I doing that? How do I impact you? I'm not prepared to concede that anything I did was wrong. I'm not going to acknowledge my impact on you in any way, shape or form. If you've got a problem with me, that's your problem, and you can go off and deal with that. But I'm not prepared to look at my own behavior and see myself as flawed.
Why do people become narcissists?
This is very difficult for people, especially the child of a narcissist, because of that motivational empathy, that it will be weaponized against them so much. They are drawn into the parents' trauma and will know, chances are, a lot about their parents' trauma. And it's thought that it is born from their trauma. And that can be done from being completely neglected, so not being loved. But what's often not looked at is that it can also happen when somebody is smothered in love. So what we talk about, the engulfing parent. So then that the child is denied their autonomy in that respect. And what we always say is that you can have compassion for their trauma, but it doesn't excuse the behavior.
Okay. And do we know any famous narcissists? Are there people around at the moment that we can pinpoint and say, there you go, that he's died? I mean, I'm thinking of Trump, obviously.
I think that's a tricky ground to get into, because without being kind of, you know, a psychologist or a psychiatrist would have to diagnose that. And I think there are psychiatrists who have openly said that he has NPD. It's difficult. I don't know if we should really...
It's interesting, because one of the things that we are very aware of is actually when this is bandied about and, you know, that people are armchair diagnosing. But I'm wondering if we're thinking in terms of, let's say, what people maybe recognize in television and to recognize maybe in programs. And there's one that I'm actually thinking about, the mother in Everybody Loves Raymond.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen that program?
Yeah.
And so here it comes across that she has absolutely the doting mother. By the way, you can see clearly that she has a favorite child, golden child, and then the other child that's ignored, and, you know, nothing he does is good enough, and he doesn't live up to her expectations. You can also see the demands and how the daughter-in-law is not good enough for her son, but how she doesn't respect their autonomy, doesn't respect their boundaries. And then when anything is said to her, she can oscillate between playing the victim and putting on the tears and being very angry and having, you know, triangulation, talking to everybody else about it rather than talking to the person. So,
okay, well, that's a good one. It's better to stay in the fictional. And maybe your man in Succession was a bit of a narcissist as well, the head of that family in Succession.
I haven't seen Succession. No.
Oh, wait, is that the one with the, like, they've got a media empire or something?
Yeah,
I saw a couple of episodes, because a lot of people actually did say to me, you should watch it because there's a narcissist. That whole system in that family is showing all the red flags that we would look for. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely, yeah.
We're looking in family systems about control and dominance. That's really what we're talking about here. Denying the person, fundamentally denying their no. So when somebody feels really guilty and bad for being a bad daughter, if I don't take my parent into town, for example. But that's where we look at, well, where is the punishment? What would happen if you say no? And then we see all these sorts of behaviors coming out from the narcissistic parent.
And the other thing to remember about the media portrayal of these is that they make it funny. And Everybody Loves Raymond, they make it funny. So they sort of make it acceptable, and that, oh, you just have to put up with them if they're like that. And it's so toxic and it's so damaging. And if you are experiencing that as a person or a child of, and you know, either your mother or your mother-in-law is behaving like that towards you or your partner, that's really hard, because then everybody thinks it's hilarious.
Yeah.
When it's, you know, yeah. So we do trivialize narcissism a lot in the media.
Yeah, as we do a lot of different conditions sometimes, you know, we're thinking of OCD or other things that we kind of just throw out there as, you know, and even in daily life, people talking about people who are narcissists, who probably aren't, who might have some narcissistic traits, as we've discussed, but not necessarily full-blown narcissists. But I suppose the reason you must have written your book is because both of you in your professional lives come across, I presume a lot of the time it's adults who have come to realize that the way they were parented was very damaging to them and has caused them a lot of grief and trouble. So tell me about the kind of people who you meet and how they've been affected by having narcissistic parents.
Yeah, I think both of us, our client group, well, there is a theory that everyone that goes to therapy has had a narcissistic parent, but that's not researched or anything, but it's just an idea that there will be wounds from childhood. And what we will see in our clients is both hyper-independence and hyper-dependence. And we'll see with hyper-dependence, you might know that as kind of codependency or people-pleasing and that kind of thing, but we decide to kind of give it a different label, because it's understanding that there's a desperate need for dependency and enmeshment with a partner or whoever. And with a hyper-dependent, we would see someone who is desperate for everyone to like them, is asking, fearful of being a burden, doesn't like to be rejected, obviously, and neither of them do. And then when we're looking at hyper-independent, we're looking at people who are struggling to ask for help, who keep people at arm's length, don't really trust people, they don't like needy people. But both of those people are doing exactly the same thing, or both of those groups are doing the same thing. And this is what we see in our clients, are people who are terrified of rejection, conflict, abandonment, and intimacy. And both those coping mechanisms will prevent them from ever experiencing those things in different ways.
Okay. And children with a narcissistic parent, they've had certain roles in the family, and you outline those in the book, such as the golden child, the scapegoat child. Talk through them, if you don't mind, just to get a sense of the kind of different positions that you can hold in a family with a narcissistic parent.
I love this because it's education on recognizing both ends, actually, what it looks like in adult and then where it comes in childhood. And everybody knows a golden child. That is the child that is pedestal from the parent, that can do no wrong. They are perfect in the parent's eyes. They're not perfect, but in the parent's eyes, they are. And we often hear somebody say, oh, they get away with murder. And, you know, they're just praised so much. The scapegoat child is the child that is blamed for absolutely everything that goes wrong in the family. The invisible child is just that, they're invisible, they're ignored, they're forgotten about. And then there is the gilded child. And that child can look like the golden child. That child will typically be enmeshed with their parent, and they have to work really hard to maintain that position. They have to grow up really early to be the parent's best friend. And often what they discover is that when they start to hold boundaries and say no, they realize that they were never the golden child.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, this is the women's podcast, so we want to talk particularly about narcissistic mothers and how they typically treat perhaps their daughters. I know your book is very general and it's great for men and women, anybody who thinks that they might have had a narcissistic parent. But it is interesting, this particular traits in narcissistic women and how they treat the females in their life. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, realistically, what we see, because therapy is kind of usually attended more by women anyway, we tend to see daughters of narcissistic mothers. The typical experience is that a narcissistic mother will be more covertly expressing, so they will be hidden, they will sit in the victim role, they will, you know, that kind of martyrdom type behavior. And then how that impacts on their daughters will be, the oldest daughter is usually the scapegoat child, because they disappoint mum by not being everything mum has decided that they should be, by fighting for the autonomy, for being the firstborn girl who actually says, no, I don't want to be it, the thing that you want me to be, I want to be myself. And so they obviously get punished for that. And then the younger girls might be invisible or golden, sometimes, very rarely, it's usually boys that are golden, firstborn boys, or gilded. So we will see gilded girls as well, very a lot, where they're very meshed with mum, their mum's therapist, best friend, their mum's confidant, they're helping with mum's relationship with partner or giving money. You know, there's a lot of pressure on those children, especially the girls, to be mum's support system. So the narcissistic mother is actually probably more likely to be represented in our therapy room simply because they have primary care usually. I mean, it's changing now, which is great, but for a long time, mothers were primary carers, and their behavior would be covert, and it would have been validated because of media, because of social constructs, and everyone puts mothers on pedestals, so they aren't allowed to be criticized. You know, it's very, very difficult.
Yeah, the perfect mother, and everybody loves their mother, which is not true, as we know, because there's mothers can be as difficult as fathers. There's no differentiation. But can you talk to me more about this golden child that would be the first son? Where does that come from?
Mm-hmm. Because of patriarchy, boys are so much more highly valued than girls. And for a long time, you think about how in all class systems, boys would be the firstborn boy would be the inheritor, and then the name carrier and everything else. And so women were praised when they had boys, criticized when they had girls, you know, and I'm not even talking that long ago. Mm-hmm. I think it's very much in existence now. And the reason that the firstborn boy becomes golden, it's because I've won. I'm as the parent, as the mother, they're golden, they can't do anything, I don't want them to leave me. And they become a bit of a surrogate spouse, actually, which is very emotionally incestuous.
And society plays into this too. Look at in Ireland that, I mean, we only have to go back into right up even into the 80s with how women were treated when they got pregnant out of wedlock, and how the boy, the man, was never held accountable at all. And I mean, the institutions that women were put into and what they were called and how they were shamed. And the man, his part and role in that was forgotten, ignored, and even praised, because this is just what they do. So the standard, what we're talking about here with the patriarchy and in all societies, you know, we can look at this specifically in Ireland, but you will see different variations of this across the world.
So tell me about some of the women, particularly, because it's interesting you say that a lot of because more women go to therapy, you're hearing more about narcissistic mothers, perhaps, and daughters. What are the ways that these women have been treated by their narcissistic mothers? I know that's a big question, but maybe you can just give us some specific kind of things that people might recognize if they hear it, the kind of ways that they've grown up. And I suppose when we all grow up, we think our lives are normal. We don't look at the way we're parented and think, oh, this is weird, until maybe we step into adulthood or we have children ourselves and we think, oh, I wouldn't do that to my child. But what are some of the ways that that narcissistic mothers treat their daughters?
I think let's sit with the scapegoat role. Is that better? Because then I think most people who can hear themselves in this podcast are going to be scapegoats. They're going to be the ones that are the truth breakers, the cycle breakers, the truth speakers and the cycle breakers. So the scapegoat role will basically that you are blamed for absolutely everything that goes wrong. Literally will never be good enough. If you have a problem with the way that your mother treats you, it's because of you and the flaws in you. The mother will be extremely critical, condescending, really oppressive, very judgmental. Oh, you're not wearing that, are you? You know, it's the entitlement, the expectation of you should drop everything and go and do their shopping, even if you are about to give a conference for 10,000 people. She is more important than anybody else. And if you ever disagree with that, you're going to get punished. So then the punishment is most likely to be not angry. I mean, there will be angry types. The critical parent can be very angry, but the mothers tend to be much more keen to use weaponizing, like things like stonewalling, where they are emotionally abandoning somebody and just kind of being, I'm not talking to you because you've upset me. And, you know, really shaming their daughters for not being good enough and not meeting the expectations. So the scapegoat will really recognize themselves that they are always at fault, they're always to blame for everything that goes wrong, and that they are never good enough. And yeah, it's desperately sad.
When they come to you, what is it that's made them come to you in a way? What usually do you find has made them sort of realize, actually, that wasn't right, and I haven't been treated well, and I need to work on that to kind of find my whole self? What kind of triggers happen to them?
Well, they will be typically coming thinking that they are the problem, that they need to communicate better. If we think of the mother parent-child relationship, I'm not getting on with my mother and I need to know how to talk to her better, how to communicate with her better. And what we're seeing then is the system that's playing throughout. When you're talking about what would somebody recognize, if we look at the child of the narcissist will be parentified, and there's three categories for the parentified child: instrumental, emotional, and then the narcissistic parentification.
Tell me about parentification, because you're both experts in that, but it's not a phrase that I've come across before. So what does parentification actually mean?
Oh, I love this question. Parentification is making a child into a parent, another parent. So it's basically saying, you are going to be my spouse, you're going to be my partner, and I'm going to hold you to a higher level of, I don't know, capability than I will your siblings. And there's three types: the instrumental, emotional, and narcissistic. Instrumental is where, and again, this typically falls to the oldest daughter. I call this the Cinderella syndrome, where the oldest daughter is asked to be the babysitter for younger siblings. They're given household chores that are beyond. And this is where people get a bit confused, because they say, well, it's good for kids to learn how to do things around the house. And absolutely, we're not saying that, are we, at all? What we're saying is there's an developmental appropriate age, and they shouldn't be punished or shamed into it. You know, they shouldn't be, oh, God, I haven't washed the dishes up and mum's going to be so angry, and I'm, oh my God, I've got to do it before they get home. It's, oh, I forgot to do the dishes, mum. Oh, come on. You know, like, you were given a job and you've got to do it. Let's get it done together. That's a reasonable kind of response to that. But what's not okay is, you let me down, you're so forgetful, you're this, that, you're so selfish for doing all these things. So parentification is this horrific burden on a child to act as an adult when they're still a child. Katie, what do you want to add?
Yeah, it's exactly that. The roles are reversed, where the child feels that the parent is so dependent on them, nearly that the family wouldn't function without them. And what they don't realize is they're being exploited. And what you can see again is that this is praised by society, that from such a young age, aren't you wonderful? You know, old head on young shoulders. I never had to worry about you. You're so independent. You bought your own school books and uniform at such a young age. And what you will even see from adulthood, that they can often refer to their siblings as, when they were younger, saying, the kids, I have to go home and mind the kids, because this responsibility was on them to rear them, to do homework, get them out to school, cooking dinners. Instrumental parentification also includes looking after a sick relative, you know, paying bills, you know, phoning for hospital appointments, stuff that is completely developmentally inappropriate.
Adult responsibilities in a childhood, essentially.
And to break it into then, to recognize the emotional parentification. And this is the one, Helen went into that earlier, where the child will be the mother's best friend, where the parent will lean on them, where they will be used as a go-between in the relationship. So, for example, the mother will confide about her relationship with the father. And this is triangulating then the child against the father, where they will use the child as that mini therapist in a really unhealthy way. Again, something that's praised in society. And this is where the child grows up to feel very codependent then in adulthood. This is where it stems from, because they feel responsible for other people's behavior, for other people's emotions. This is where the term, you know, empath is born, but there is no such thing as empath. That is where typically what they're describing is growing up in an environment where they had to walk on eggshells around their parent, managing their parent's emotion to avoid punishment.
Okay.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
And so when they grow up then and they have their own relationships, perhaps, presumably, and you go into it in the book, that the way that people are in their relationships is really affected by how they've been parented in this way by narcissistic mothers, say. So a woman going into a relationship, tell us about some of the ways that this toxicity that they've experienced as children then can bleed into their own romantic relationships.
This is such an important thing because I think this is why people, rather something that we can't emphasize enough is impacting you as an adult now, is your childhood patterns come into your adulthood. So if you grow up with a narcissistic mother, being taught that love looks like criticism, judgment, shame, punishment, stonewalling, like chronic verbal abuse sometimes, you know, really nasty experience, then when you move into adulthood, you think that when you meet a person, a partner, who is then also using shame and criticism and judgment and stonewalling and verbal abuse, they love you because your relational pattern is set in childhood. And so when we're sitting with these relational patterns that are very, very damaging, that I'm only valuable if I'm in servitude to somebody else, that, which is what happens with them at instrumental parentification, that I'm only going to be wanted or needed if I'm doing stuff for everyone else, then all your relationships are going to be based on you doing things for other people, which in turn gets heavily exploited. You're extremely vulnerable to abusive relationships. So yeah, it's really, really important to understand how much this impacts us.
So do you find sometimes when women particularly come and they're talking about, you know, maybe they're talking about their relationships, and then underneath that you will discover the reason that they're putting up with, say, what is abusive behaviour is because that's what they were used to as a child?
We do. We see this relational pattern where the tracks are laid from the narcissistic parent. And if they're in an abusive relationship, we are looking at this thread back to childhood. Let's take one of those examples that, you know, you had mentioned, the stonewalling. To be able to label this, what people might recognise is, let's say if they were sharing something with their parent or partner, oh, I did this wonderful thing. Let's name something. If somebody got engaged, or if they got a promotion, or if they did anything that they were happy or had joy or pride about. And stonewalling would sound like, oh, right, did you hear about Joan up the road? She did this thing. She got this thing last week. Or, you know, if they share something again that this happened. Oh, okay, I have to go into town. It's ignored, it's dismissed, it's always compared then to somebody else, that somebody else is better. So you're never getting that acknowledgement. You're never being seen for an achievement unless it directly benefits the narcissistic parent. So yes, when somebody is recognizing this behavior with a partner, they will then start to learn and see and recognize this behavior. Whereas that term stonewalling, they would just think, oh, maybe I'm uninteresting, I'm boring, this isn't, you know, and they can be made feel like, oh, well, I was looking for attention there and there was something wrong with me. Whereas this is very normal. And when they're in healthy relationships, they will see that they are celebrated, encouraged, you know, that somebody is going to champion them, be their fan and want to do well.
I mean, this book is not for the narcissist, because as we know, the narcissist just generally doesn't know they're a narcissist and isn't much minded to go to therapy and try and discover about themselves. So we can't really do much about that, perhaps, but it is for the person. So is there healing in this? Is there a way to come out from that relationship of having a narcissistic mother, say a daughter who becomes an adult who realizes through therapy that this, you know, that what's happened? How do they navigate that relationship with, say, the narcissistic parent, instigate boundaries, make sure that they can have a healthy relationship and going forward? Is there successful stories from the people you've worked with
to have relationships with narcissistic mothers? It's very difficult. This is really hard because this is where the grief is. And it's a question we get a lot, because I think people really want to be able to do that. And that's valid. You know, of course, we don't want the grief. We sit in called toxic hope. We talk about that in You're Not the Problem. And we sit in that toxic hope that if I could just do enough, they'll change. Or if I just do enough, they won't hurt me. If I could just change this thing about myself, they might accept me as I am. And unfortunately, what tends to happen is that, or in my experience, and Katie might want to share something different, but my experience is that my clients will come in sort of saying, I don't want to go no contact. And we sit with, okay, that's fine. We're not going to, we're here for your gain, mm-hmm. what you want to get from this session and thing. But inevitably what tends to happen is as they grow their identity, their autonomy, their boundaries and their healthy communication styles, because yes, you can heal from this kind of impact. They have less and less patience for where it's not being shown back to them. And so at best, what we have is a very detached relationship with the narcissistic parent. But what we typically see is that no contact ends up happening simply because our client group starts going, I deserve healthy love. I deserve to be respected and I deserve to have my boundaries and that I shouldn't be shamed for doing so. And it becomes intolerable to stay in relationships. But, you know, everyone has to walk their own path. Katie, what do you think?
I absolutely agree. This is never our decision and we would never project that onto our clients. But when you're asking what client comes in, it's a client that has low self-worth. It's a client that is anxious or depressed. It is a client that is struggling with an eating disorder, with low moods. Again, that there's thinking that there's something fundamentally wrong with them. And they typically don't know who they are. So they can say, I am the daughter, I am the mother, I am the employee or the business person, but I actually don't know what I want. I don't know what needs are. I don't know what my preferences are. And in therapy, the healing is that the self-worth grows, that this identity building, they can identify their wants and needs and preferences. And then in particular boundaries. So I know where I end and the other person begins. And they're able to recognize when they're being exploited, when they're being used or manipulated. So they're empowered then to hold their no and not be manipulated into feeling sorry for the other person. And the more that that happens, that somebody heals, as Helen said, the less they're going to accept being either abused or tolerated. You know, the child in this environment is thought that to be tolerated is to be loved. That's what they expect. And often then that's what they expect in their adult relationships. Whereas when they learn that healthy love and have healthier relationships and healthy communication, the narcissist will reject that because they will reject that autonomy and freedom. They will reject that choice and they will try to fit the child back into the box that they had conditioned them to. This is the third narcissistic parentification.
Okay. Mm. Now, you have something called the grey rock method in the book as a kind of a tactic for people who have come to a point where they don't want to have no contact. They still have to maintain contact with the narcissistic parent. Tell me about the grey rock method.
The grey rock method is, if you can imagine being as boring as a rock, it's putting the narcissist on an information diet, right? Because information is currency. They will want to know everything about you, not because they're interested in you, but because they can share this. So it's not sharing anything that can be used against you and holding those boundaries. And then the grey rock method was anybody that has to be in a relationship. So think if somebody has been in a marriage and they have to parallel parent. And so they have to be in communication with somebody, because grey rock can be damaging if you are doing this to yourself all the time, because you're not free to express yourself. So it's very boundaried communication, limiting information.
Okay. I mean, I'm going to give this example because I thought it was interesting. Just one of the examples you give. When Jane's mother asked her to do something she didn't want to do, instead of just saying no or I'm busy, she often justified why she was saying no, which gave her mother room to challenge her. For example, Jane's mum says, I need you to take me to the shops at 3 o'clock today. And Jane says, I'm so sorry, mum. I have to take the kids swimming at 3:30, so I won't be able to. And Jane's mum says, well, you can take me at 2:30 then. That gives you plenty of time to drop me off and pick them up. Then you can pick me up after they finish swimming and take me home before them. And so Jane feels backed into a corner and says yes, despite not wanting to take her mother shopping at all. But if Jane had used grey rock, it would have looked like this. Jane's mum would have said, I need you to take me to the shops at 3 o'clock. Jane would say, sorry, I can't today, I'm busy. And then Jane's mum would say, too busy to take me to the shops. And she'd say, yes, sorry. Speaking of which, I must get on. Have a good day. Bye. Yeah. And so by not justifying why she couldn't meet her mum's needs, she left no room for negotiation. And therefore, she was not manipulated into doing what her mum wanted. Jane's mum would have been annoyed at first, but eventually she would have started to realise that she couldn't just use Jane to do her bidding and she would have to stop asking. So that's a kind of clear example about that withholding information and how powerful that can be in a narcissistic relationship.
Absolutely. And I think what's so important in that with Jane is she's not being nasty. She's not being snarky or short or cold. She's like, yeah, have a good day. Bye. And I think that's something people get really wrong about Grey Rock is that they think it's cold, but it's not. You're just not being interesting. And actually what that does typically provoke. So in that instance, Jane's mum eventually gives up, but eventually Jane's mother will get annoyed. She's on the information diet. And eventually there might be a blow up and then there might be a discard from Jane's mum towards Jane. So Grey Rock, you know, it's very helpful for us to manage the communication and the boundaries, but ultimately, eventually it does kind of get to a place where a fracture in the relationship is going to happen at some point.
You also have a chapter called Fuck Forgiveness. Discuss this.
Yes, we do.
Why Fuck Forgiveness?
Fuck Forgiveness is aptly titled because society can again blame the child in the scenario and say, be the bigger person. Can you not forgive and forget? And that you need to forgive in order to heal. And that is fundamentally not true. You do not have to forgive in order to heal. And the forgiveness is actually to the self. Because the child growing up in this will think that there's something wrong with them and will blame themselves, that I am too needy, too demanding, too cold-hearted, and I should be different. And they have done that to survive because it's more hopeful for the child to think that. When we're talking about this grief, for adult children to recognize that their parents won't change and the damage it did to them, that is devastating. And for the child, it is more hopeful to think, actually, it is me. I'm the problem, because then if I'm the problem, I can change. Mm-hmm. And then I can get the love mm-hmm. that I deserve and need. And so the forgiveness is actually to the self and to the younger self, so the inner child.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really important point. And I think your point about everyone expecting you to be the bigger person is really, there's a lot of societal expectations in this that don't help people who've actually been through a narcissistic parent. There's a book by Jeanette McCurdy, I'm Glad My Mum Died. I don't know if you know about that book.
I have read it,
And it really showed what life is like living with a narcissistic mother. And some people were really shocked or uncomfortable with the title of that book. But would you say that's the reality, unfortunately, for many women living with narcissistic mothers, that in a way their death or their separation or whatever way that comes is a relief?
Absolutely. And I mean, it's just a sad, tragic truth that it's not that you want your mother to die, it's that you want to be free. And I think what Jeanette McCurdy is talking about throughout that book is all her trauma, but the liberation that her mother's death brought her, that she was allowed to breathe and grow and swell into herself without the fear of mother's criticism. I mean, have you read the book?
I haven't read it, but I've read a lot about it, yeah.
So she talks about going on holiday with her boyfriend and not telling her mother, and that while she was there, she was papped, but you know, the paparazzi got her and published these photos, and she just got a barrage of abusive emails from her mother and was so badly impacted. They went home, and it's this, you know, that's what we're talking about. You're not allowed to move. You're frozen in this expectation of what you should be, or the punishment is so huge. And we have to remember that this is a parent-child relationship. So the parent has huge power in that relationship, and the narcissistic parent weaponizes it over and over and over again.
And the grief that we're talking about is generally not the grief of the parent as they are. Mm-hmm. It's the grief of the parent that they wish they had. It's the grief of the parent that they deserved.
And they didn't get.
Yeah.
That they didn't get.
Yeah. Which is a grief. And do you encourage your clients to grieve actually the loss of that parent that they never had?
Absolutely. And we have exercises in the book actually how to do this, because grief is such a painful emotion, but it's actually one of the most healing emotions. And when we think that in a narcissistic family system, a lot of people can recognize that it's the more difficult emotions to feel that are denied. So sadness is denied. You know, you're told that you should be grateful, suck it up, you know. But also joy is denied. Excitement is denied. So now when something really pleasurable is happening or something good is happening, we hear our clients say, I'm waiting for the shoe to drop. You know, I'm sitting in that unease because they have walked on eggshells. And when something as good is happening at home, they are knowing that simply if I laugh with my sibling, my narcissistic parent can take that personally and it will blow up. So yeah. It's actually then learning to sit in these behaviors, and it can be, or sitting these emotions, and it can be very uncomfortable at first, but that is the learning. And again, there's exercises in the book, how to get in touch with your own values to build identity, because this has been denied.
Yeah. And I know we said fuck forgiveness, but in many cases, I suppose I'm thinking of these narcissistic mothers who then had narcissistic mothers themselves who were treated, who didn't have the parents they deserved either. And there's this intergenerational thing that continues mm-hmm. on. So, I mean, is it fair to have some compassion for the narcissistic mother and to kind of think, maybe, is there any possibility of helping them, or is that just out of the question?
You know, that's what we were talking about at the beginning, isn't it? When we were talking about narcissism being born of trauma, that we can acknowledge that they also had a really rough ride, that they developed a really unhealthy coping mechanism to be able to exist in the world. And that is desperately sad, like so, so sad that they had to develop that. And we can have huge compassion for it. It wasn't their fault, but it is their responsibility to change it. It is their responsibility to make sure that they're not inflicting wounds on their children, their people around them, because of what happened to them. All of us are responsible for that. And so I think it's, again, coming back to, we can have huge compassion for that trauma, but it doesn't mean we have to tolerate their behavior. You know, it's sad, but it's not okay, the wounding they do, the level of wounding.
And I think when people really understand the impact of what emotional abuse is and understand what it is, when we think back in Ireland to the corporal punishment in the 60s and 70s and how that was normalized and the child was blamed. Well, what did you do, you know, to get that slap, to get that beating? And when we realized how damaging it was and how wrong it was, a stop was put to it. And when we think to somebody that isn't recognizing that their behavior is harmful, would we say to somebody in any sort of relationship like that, saying, well, they had a tough day, so mm-hmm. you know, they're deserving to take it out on you, and why don't you do something different? And here, what in You're Not the Problem, we're showing actually that the cornerstone of all abuse is emotional abuse in relationships, that for any sort of physical or sexual abuse to take place in long-term relationships, there is emotional abuse there. And that is, the impact of that is devastating and is lifelong. And so recognizing how damaging this is, nobody then would ask, unless they are abusive and it's for their own gain, or they're in their own denial, they don't want to see it about their own relationship. Mm. They would never ask somebody to stay in an abusive relationship, because that's what they're saying, tolerate the abuse.
Mm-hmm. Is it ever narcissistic siblings, or is it always parents?
Mm-hmm. Mm. That's a really good question. And it's also a difficult question, because when there is a narcissistic sibling, again, we will see where this was born from, and we will trace it back to childhood, and we will see where the parents' involvement was. Again, when it's the more critical or ignoring parent, that can be, you know, more overt and more obvious to see. And one, again, that is kind of hidden is where the mother is engulfing and absolutely smothers and dotes on her boy, you know, can call an adult man her baby and her child, and then call his children, give me my child. That's your grandchild, you know. But this is where they're seeing them as the extension of themselves, and will have intense jealousy of their son's wife, you know, that she's not good enough, and be very critical of her, especially if she is in any way healthy and trying to hold accountability and boundaries. So yeah, where we see a narcissistic sibling, we would see a narcissistic parent. Helen, I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, I'm in agreement. And I think it's one of the trickiest things, because I get it in my comment sections on socials quite a lot, that I don't have a narcissistic parent, I had a narcissistic sibling. And whilst the smallest of caveats around that, there's thought to potentially be a genetic element, that nothing's been established, at least as far as I'm aware. So I just, you know, just want to allow space for the idea that we might be wrong. We're very often not, 99.9% of the time, we are going to be seeing that there is narcissistic parenting. But again, going back to what we said right at the beginning, it's so normalized to you as the person in it that you don't think there's anything wrong with it until someone like us comes along and says, this is that and this is that, and you know, you shouldn't be experiencing
and joins
that.
Up all the dots. The book is called You're Not the Problem, and it's an amazing resource for people. And I wonder, I know it's only just out, have you already had kind of feedback from people who are like, thank you for writing this book?
Yeah. The feedback has been, I mean, I could get emotional.
It's
unbelievable when people, how empowered they feel. And I mean, it packs a punch, you know, being able to recognize this and being able to see this and to recognize this right back where it starts. You know, when we think of if somebody keeps driving over a nail and keeps getting a puncture, and if all we keep doing is putting a plaster on that, whereas what we're doing is going back to see, okay, well, where are you getting punctured? Where is the harm? So the feedback has been phenomenal.
The feedback in, so we've got a Facebook group where lots of people who follow our podcast come and chat to each other and support each other, which is just phenomenal in itself. But they obviously, a lot of them have ordered and received book, and just the posts in there I have to be careful because they make us cry.
Yeah, they do.
They really, the moving, and I think what people are surprised by the book is that we hold them accountable. We ask them to look at their own behavior and we say, yes, you developed this, just as I was saying before, you developed this because of your trauma, but it's not helping you anymore and it's hurting people around you, so it does need to change. But have compassion to yourself in that, for the child who survived an environment they should never have been in.
And you would see them as survivors.
Absolutely. These are victims of abuse, and you know, they have survived environments that are terribly wounding, like literally alter your brain development and, you know, create behavioral patterns that are really very difficult to undo. And so definitely survivors.
Yeah. So, but there is hope out there. Your book is one bit of the hope, but there's also lots of resources, because you did mention at the beginning that everyone has the money for therapy, and therapy can be expensive. So can you point us to some other resources maybe that there are for people who might be interested and recognize some of what you're talking about?
Absolutely. On our website, insidepodcast.com, we have loads of resources for people in different countries to be able to click on links. There's paid resources and also free resources, the Facebook being one of them, the Facebook group there, if people want to check it out.
Yeah. And if they don't want to join our Facebook group, which is, you know, fine.
Absolutely.
No punishment, no shaming.
See, they have autonomy.
Healthy boundaries, you can do what you like. But there are loads of resources online. Facebook is great for groups and forums and stuff. So it's finding communities. Therapy isn't the only way to heal. It would be our suggested preferred way to heal. But yeah, there's loads of books. There's loads of online forums. But maybe start with You're Not the Problem.
And I'm presuming neither of you had narcissistic parents.
There's such a curiosity around this that I can understand, and it's very important for us as therapists that we, in the same in the therapy room as the same as then outside of it, that we don't want to color the work with our personal stories. Helen, would you have anything to say?
Yeah, absolutely. As therapists, we're really boundaries, and we don't do something called self-disclosure. Mm. And so if we start sharing our own experience, it is going to impact how people absorb and read the work. So we would, we don't talk
about
it.
It was worth a try anyway. I mean, it's been fascinating talking to you. And I think what you've done is something really, really valuable for people, because it's one of those things that it can be quite subtle. It can be quite hard to detect. And I'm sure there's plenty of people who die and never realize that that's what was their experience.
Yes,
and don't realize that maybe some of the very difficult challenges in their lives could be traced back to their experiences with a narcissistic parent. So really, you're giving people a chance at that freedom you mentioned earlier, and a way to live that's much more healthy. And from what you're saying, there is healing and there is hope for people. So people shouldn't think that that's it, that they can't come out of those terrible experiences.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. There is hope and healthy relationships then on the other side of this and the learning.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Helen Villers and Katie McKenna, for talking to us today.
Thank you.
That was Helen Villers and Katie McKenna there, and their book is called You're Not the Problem, The Impact of Narcissism and Emotional Abuse and How to Heal. If you enjoyed this episode and the podcast, please leave us a review or subscribe to us, as it really makes a difference. The podcast is produced by Suzanne Brennan and by me, Roisin Ingle, with JJ Vernon on sound. Talk to us on social at IT Women's Podcast, or email us thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. That's it from me. Mind yourselves, and I will talk to you next time.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.